Daniel Webster is, I believe, often wrongfully attributed with a quotation. The false quotation is this: truth is stranger than fiction. As far as I can tell, that's not what Daniel Webster said. Now, Daniel Webster is a man who lived several hundred years ago, who was not only a very polished speaker and writer, but decided that the English language needed a dictionary. And he's generally attributed to be the first one who actually put together a dictionary of English words. And we still use his name today, even though he probably has no connection at all to most modern dictionaries. But he's sort of the father of the English dictionary. And so we talk about Webster's dictionary and Merriam-Webster's dictionary, and they're just trading off of the man's name, even though there's very little connection between what he did and what we have now. They've advanced so far. But he's attributed, I think, with having said, truth is stranger than fiction. But here's what he really said: there is nothing as powerful as truth, and often nothing as strange. You need to realize that he was a wordsmith. He was a man who had devoted his life to understanding the meaning of words. And so when he talks about truth not only being powerful, he also said, and often nothing as strange, he is using the word strange not in the sense of odd, but rather in the sense of rare or infrequent. And that is one of the meanings of the word strange, and probably was the dominant meaning several hundred years ago when he spoke that. What did he mean by that? There is nothing as powerful as truth. That part seems to be fairly obvious. But then he says, and often nothing as strange or rare. He's actually saying that truth is a commodity not commonly found. And we live in a world today in which that's all too obvious. Plain, simple truth about matters seems to be a rare commodity today. We, sadly, often joke about some of those institutions and individuals in our society who are known for their half-truths, untruths, gross exaggerations, outright lies, and even insinuations that are not true. These, though it's not fair to tarnish everyone's reputation by that, these often include salespeople, politicians, radio commentators, advertisers, and big business, even many books, novels, movies, TV programs, and so-called documentaries. And now it's even spilled over into the area of those who are labeled as scientists and researchers, in which truth does not seem to be a valuable thing. As we're coming up this coming Tuesday to a runoff election between several of our state offices, our ears and our eyes are besieged by claims and counterclaims, accusations and denials, charges and countercharges by those seeking office. And I don't know if you're like me or not, but it's got to the point I don't believe any of them. Because even if there's a germ of truth in what they're saying, it seems like the majority of the time they have drawn it completely out of either the context of the event or the content of what was said, or has isolated it from everything else that might be said about the other person. And we had an interesting thing happen here. I'm trying to remember now whether it's 2 years or 4 years ago. I believe it was 2 years ago, out in our little town of Friendship, out on the edge of Lubbock. Had two men running for city council there. And when the election was held, they received each exactly the same number of votes. It was a tie. And as I recall what happened, at least, it was decided by the city clerk or whoever that they would just meet together down at the city offices on a certain day and they would flip a coin to decide who would receive the office. But when they arrived at that date, one of the two men stepped up and said, "We don't need a coin flip. This man over here is good and honest and will serve this city well, and I concede to him." Not what you would expect out of a politician. Of course, these men really were not politicians. They were just a couple of citizens who wanted to serve their community. Truth is a rare commodity. We live in a time of great truth decay, where almost nothing we hear or see can be taken without at least a grain of salt. And some things, certainly a big question mark arises over them. There's one area in which we would hope, at least, and we seek to try in our society to have truth, and that's in our court system, where the lives and even the deaths of people are being considered. And so our court system has long struggled to establish truth as the ultimate criterion. Someone found to be guilty of perjury after having been put under oath can be punished for that. And yet even at those times we know that perjury is going on. If someone is called up to sit and testify, did you commit this crime? No, I didn't commit that crime. They may well be lying. There seemed to be enough evidence to have put them on trial in the first place. And so truth is not as valuable to them as trying to get out of the punishment that's going to come as a result of it. We acknowledge the high value of truth, and we want truth to always be told to us. We love truth as a culture. But in practice, we acknowledge that less than truth is often the thing under consideration. And by and large, most of our culture now just sort of winks the eye or nods the head that, yeah, that's just how things happen. Sadly, that was also happening in Jesus' day. And it was happening among those who were supposed to be the very paragons, the very leaders and examples in truth. Those people were called the Pharisees and teachers of the law of God. And when we turn to the Sermon on the Mount, where we've been studying, we've already been noticing how Jesus is taking one by one many of the things these leaders were guilty of and labeling it as hypocrisy. That is, pretending to do or be something they were not. They were claiming to obey God's law while breaking the intent of God's law. They were pretending to be examples of what a true, obedient follower of God and believer in God should be, while in fact their lives were very contrary to that. And Jesus' battle verbally with them, his entire ministry focused around this hypocrisy on their part. And we've already looked at how he says, "You say, thou shalt not murder, but you hate people. And then you come to God and offer your sacrifices and offer your gifts with this hatred in your heart towards someone else and expect God to accept it. Because after all, you didn't actually strike them down and physically kill them. And so you think that's okay with God. It's not okay, Jesus. And those who are going to be a part of my kingdom will have to have a righteousness that exceeds this." That's what he's laying down in the Sermon on the Mount, is not only showing what the problem with the Pharisees and teachers of the law of God was, but also delineating what a true follower of Jesus is going to look like. Then he will say, "You say rightly that the law says, thou shalt not commit adultery. But you do two things. You lust after a woman in your heart, and you make divorce so easy that you've legalized adultery. Not so with my disciples." And now he says in Matthew chapter 5 and in verse 33, "Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but keep the oaths you have made to the Lord." So he's quoting what they've been taught. He's, of course, realize he's not primarily speaking. His audience is not primarily the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. It's just ordinary people who are following Jesus. But they've heard from the Pharisees, their teachers, that God says, do not break your oath, but keep the oaths you have made to the Lord. There's not actually a command just in those words anywhere in the Old Testament. And even different than the first two that he had about thou shalt not murder and thou shalt not commit adultery, it's not even in the Ten Commandments. But this is sort of a summation of many things God had said in his law in the Old Testament. There were two commands in the Ten Commandments that are reflected in this. The first of them is the one that says, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. That is, you shall not use God's name in a profane or empty way. And the other command is, thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor. That is, you shall not lie about your neighbor. But neither one of those directly is talking about oaths, are they? For here he says, do not break your oath, but keep the oaths you have made to the Lord. This particular idea is found probably most closely in the law in Leviticus chapter 19, where we turn back there to read that in verse 12. Do not swear falsely by my name, God says, and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. And there are other commands as well that have to do with oaths and vows and things like that. So Jesus is addressing this popular notion among the religious leaders that had filtered down then to those who heard them teach, that we should cherish truth and yet not necessarily actually practice it. What were they doing? What do we understand about what the Pharisees and the teachers of the law and therefore then the people were doing in that time? Well, they had two different practices besides just simple conversation with each other and simple things that happen all day long about between people. First of all, they had oaths they were taking. An oath was something that was given in order to try to reinforce the truth of what you were saying. I swear this is true. We're not talking about what they were doing in legal terms. They were put under oath when they were in court. Just like even at Jesus' trial, finally the high priest comes up to Jesus and says, I adjure you. What that meant was, I am putting you under oath to tell the truth. Are you the Christ? But this isn't talking about what they did in court cases. It's talking about just in their everyday business with each other. Truth had become so loose among them that they often felt like they had to swear that they were telling the truth in order to convince the other person they were. That they would do what they said to do, or they would fulfill a contract, or they would pay a bill, or they would finish a job, or whatever it might be. So there was a matter of oaths. But there's also the matter of vows. And the vow had more especially to do with what they were doing toward God. In other words, they would put themselves under a vow, a commitment, a promise to God that they would do something toward Him. It might be make a certain sacrifice, give a certain gift, change something in their life, or whatever it might be. And Jesus is actually addressing both of those. For as he goes on to speak here, he says, you've heard this said from long ago, do not break your oath, but keep your oaths you have made to the Lord. But I tell you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. He also addresses this several other places in what we have recorded of him. The one that really stands out the most to me is the one found in Matthew chapter 23. After having dealt with these people for about 3 years and trying to get them to see how far off they were from what God desired of them, Jesus has this scathing public speech and rebuke he gives towards them, which really stands out in our mind because he keeps saying, woe to you. And saying that meant you are condemned by God. You are under God's judgment because you do these things. And among those things he says in Matthew chapter 23 is verse 16. He says, woe to you blind guides. You say, if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. See, they had set up a whole set of inside rules that the general public apparently was not always aware of, about what things you could swear by, and if it actually came up in court, you wouldn't be held accountable for. But if you swore by certain other things, then you were considered liable to do what you said. So where's the love of truth in that? If someone's worked out a careful system of things you could use as sort of code words, key words, when you swore that either obligated you or freed you from obligation to do what you said. So it says, you say if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath. You blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? You also say if anyone swears by the altar, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift on it, he is bound by his oath. Are the you blind men, which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it. And he who swears by the temple swears by it and by the one who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by God's throne and by the one who sits on it. He's expanding on the same thing he says back here in the Sermon on the Mount, that they were using all these things that were usually considered sacred. Heaven, God's throne in heaven, the temple, the gold that covered the face of the front of the temple, the great altar that was out in front of the temple where sacrifices were made, the sacrifices that were made on it, and even their own head. Apparently sometimes someone would swear, I swear as surely as there's hair on my head that I'll do it. Well, everybody could see if there's hair on his head or not. And so the other person then would be convinced they would do it. And then maybe they wouldn't do it anyway. And if it ever got challenged, then they could take it to a legal expert in their day, and the expert would say, he swore by the temple, but not by the gold on the temple, so he's not obligated to do it. Where's the love of truth in that, Jesus? God had not only bound them to keep their oath, God had bound them to tell the truth all through that law of Moses. And yet here they were devising means and ways to actually lie while making it look like they were telling the truth. And we go back to what Jesus has to say here in the Sermon on the Mount. His instructions to his own disciples then in verse 37 of Matthew 5 is simply let your yes be yes and your no, no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. Jesus tells his disciples, he tells us, we don't need to swear. We don't need to make oaths. If truth is valuable to us, and if we're his disciples, it will be, then all we have to say is yes or no. We don't have to swear. We don't need to make an oath. Even when we're going to make an offering or a gift to God or pledge ourselves to do something to God, we don't even have to make a vow. If I say I will give this to God, it's his. I don't need to say any more. If I say no, I can't do that, that settles it. I don't have to. No one has to accuse me of not keeping a vow because I simply said yes or no. Notice there when we were reading in Matthew 23 what Jesus called them. He called them blind guides. They were trying to guide other people and they were blind. That takes on special meaning in my family because I have a son who's blind. Now, he sees a little, and yet by the terms of law, he fits the qualifications very well, unfortunately, of being blind. And so often when he gets out of the car, I take him to work every morning and bring him to work home every evening after work. When he gets out of the car, if my granddaughter, his oldest child, is there with us, and she sometimes comes into the office with him, when they get out of the car, she reaches over and takes her dad's hand. Not because he's going to lead her, but because she's going to lead. She is the guide. It helps him to keep from stumbling and tripping over things he can't. Stepping up when he comes to a step up on the pavement or anything like that. But Jesus calls these men blind guides. How can a blind person lead anyone else? If they can't see truth and understand truth themselves, if they don't value truth any more than this, they are blind guides. Anyone who follows them is going to be taken entirely in the wrong direction. But more than that, he calls them blind men. But then the third term he used there in Matthew 23 of them, and all in this one section on their lying and their swearing, is blind fools. We had a discussion a few weeks ago about the different terms for fool that's translated all by that one English word, but in the Greek language there are different words. The one Jesus uses there is one who is stupid. Stupid not in the sense of we often slurringly say to someone, but someone who is so intellectually deprived. We would say someone with a low IQ. An extreme version of it our language uses and it's misused by us today is actually what Jesus is saying of men who try to get around telling the truth while all the time pretending to be telling it. This tells us Jesus feels very strongly about this, doesn't it? And he even tells his own disciples, he tells us, don't swear at all. Now again, he's not talking about what should happen in a court case or anything like that, but he's talking about in our everyday life and conversation and living with others. We don't have to swear, yet we hear people all the time. They'll say, by God. That was unfortunately my grandmother's favorite term. And yet ask anybody else in my family. She felt like she had to say that because about half the time she was fabricating something. She was not the world's most honest. Disciples of Jesus, us, we must be those who love truth so much we would not even require using an oath to try to convince people we're telling the truth. Our whole life should be an example of truth telling. And they know a simple yes or no on our part is sufficient. But Jesus said there in Matthew 5, in verse 36, anything beyond this comes from the evil one. And again, in one of his confrontations with these Jewish teachers of the law, these hypocritical people, over in John chapter 8, he talks to them about it. If they will come to him, they'll know the truth. The truth will set them free. Now later, when he talks about truth with Pilate, even when his life is on the line, Pilate says, what is truth? There's a man who doesn't have much use for it, isn't there? What is truth? Truth's not important to me. But to these people, he said, if you come to me, you'll know the truth. And then he tells them, you're trying to kill me because I'm telling you the truth. And what do they say? We're not trying to kill you. That was a lie. They were working behind the scenes to try to find some way to kill Jesus. But they publicly said, we're not trying to kill you. And then as he goes on with this, he says in John chapter 8 and in verse 44, you belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desire. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is the father, or he is a liar and the father of lies. Yet because I tell the truth, you do not believe me. Jesus says, not only do you want to kill me, you're lying about it. You're doing just what your father wants you to. But your father's not God, by the way you're acting. Your father's the devil. That's why he says back there in Matthew 5, anything beyond just saying yes or no comes from the evil one. So while we live in a culture in which truth is not cherished except in principle, it's certainly not cherished in practice, we have to be different if we're going to be followers of Christ. It tells us in James 5, here is probably the brother of Jesus, who's thought to be the author of the book of James, tells us the same thing. For it says in James chapter 5 and verse 12, above all, my brothers, do not swear, not by heaven or by earth or by anything else. Let your yes be yes and your no, no, or you will be condemned. Paul will tell the Christians he writes to in Ephesians chapter 4. And these were people who were not Jewish, so they didn't have this Jewish background. They were out of the pagan world, but the pagan world struggled with truth just as much as the Jewish world did. He says in Ephesians 4:25, therefore each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbor, for we are all members of one body. Truth. Speak truthfully. And among those things that are mentioned that God hates, Old Testament and New Testament, are those who are liars. And so Proverbs will tell us in Proverbs chapter 6 and in verse 16 and 17, there are six things the Lord hates, seven things that are detestable to him. Now we saw last week when we were talking about divorce, even though it's not listed in this group of seven here, God does say over in Malachi chapter 3, I hate divorce. Here God says, here's seven other things I hate too. Haughty eyes, That is, someone who's looking down on everyone else and thinking they're better than others. A lying tongue, in other words, liars. Hands that shed innocent blood, murderers. A heart that devises wicked schemes. Feet that are quick to rush into evil. And a false witness who pours out lies, and a man who stirs up dissension among brothers. So God says, these are the kind of things I hate. And there in the group, of course, is the liar. And again, in Proverbs 12 and 22, the Lord detests lying lips, but He delights in men who are true. And so is it any surprise when we get to the very end of the Bible, the last book written, and the very end of that book where John is picturing the judgment day at the end of the world. He tells us there in Revelation 21, 7 and 8, He who overcomes will inherit all this, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters, and all liars, their place will be in the fiery lake of burning sulfur. We were joking, and it's actually no joking matter, it's just we don't know any other way to handle it, that one of our brothers in Christ, who's popular on television these days, recently was asked to speak at a church up in New York. And in the sermon he preached, he read either this passage or another similar one in the Scripture that talks about the things that will cause people to be lost and not be saved. And that got picked up by the newspapers and the media. And of course, the headline says that he's guilty of anti-gay comments. Well, he's also guilty of comments against liars and against all who are sexually immoral and against murderers. But none of that got picked up. God said, these are the things that will cause people to be condemned before Him. And Jesus tells us, let your yes be yes and your no, no. We ought to make truth, knowing it, telling it, cherishing it, our number one priority. Now, we've got several things that are number one priorities, and that needs to be one of them, truth. Don't pass on things that we don't know for sure is truth. Don't say things that we're not for sure is truth. Don't even honor those who tell untruths. Truth, it makes all the difference to God.